helping children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. People who work with children who have fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, or FASD, call it a hidden disability, one that is hard to diagnose but is widespread. They estimate that FASD affects 1 in 20 first graders. But there is help for them, and the earlier that a child is identified, the greater their chances are of living up to their full potential. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss efforts to identify babies with FASD, how to encourage mothers to talk openly without fear of stigma, and what help and resources are available. We'll also learn about new federal legislation just introduced today. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders next on Maine Calling. But first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It has been called a hidden disability, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And today we're going to learn about the causes of FASD and efforts to raise awareness of it. Joining me, Dr. Douglas Waite, who is Chief of Developmental Pediatrics at Bronx Care Health System and Assistant Director of Pediatrics at Mount Sinai Medical Center's Icon School of Medicine. Also with us, two of the co-founders of FASD Maine, Constance Mazelski and Madonna Mooney. We invite your questions and comments. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And in just a second, we're going to go to a very special caller, Susan Shepherd Carlson, who's calling in from Minnesota. But before we do that, Doug Waite, I want to ask you one very important question. We are using this acronym, FASD, Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders. And I think many of us grew up with an entirely different expression, which is fetal alcohol syndrome. What is the difference between what we called this in the past and the way it's referred to now? I expect that it's just because we understand what happens much better than we used to.
Right, Jennifer. This fetal alcohol syndrome was first described in 1972 by Ken Jones at the University of Washington State Hospital. And he found a series of children, that newborns, that had facial features. And the bottom line was that all the mothers were had known alcoholism. They subsequently had developmental delays that he described as fetal alcohol syndrome. So facial features and some growth impairment in height and weight. We've since learned that the facial features are the tip of the iceberg. Far more common are the neurodevelopmental, the challenges in development that parents really bring to us because their children are having difficulties either in their developmental milestones or behavior or in school. And only 1 in 10 kids with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder has facial features. So we're really talking about, when you said hidden disability, that's exactly right. It's not something that you see in the face necessarily. And parents don't bring their kids to us because of their kid's face. They bring them because the child is having difficulty with development or behavior.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that clarification, and very important since only 1 in 10 have perhaps what many of us grew up understanding this disability to be. On the line with us, as I mentioned, Susan Shepherd Carlson, a retired juvenile court judge and former First Lady of Minnesota, who is a board member of the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome and helped draft the FASD Respect Act. Judge Carlson, thanks so much for joining us. Susan Carlson, are you there?
I am there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, tell us, how did you get involved in this issue of fetal alcohol syndrome, now referred to as FASD?
Okay, so I did get in. Well, thank you, first of all, for doing the show. I think it's incredibly important. And I've been involved in this field for over two decades. And it began when I was first lady in the 90s. And also I was a juvenile court judge. And I began to question about the youth that came before me because they had mental health problems, behavior problems, learning problems, and there were significant substance abuse issues in their families. And so I just started educating myself because as a juvenile court officer, you look at what we call psych evals, and they would highlight if there was brain trauma after birth, but never would really highlight anything about brain trauma occurring before birth. And so that's how I began. And fortunately, I was in the right place at the right time, married to the governor. And so we did a comprehensive effort in Minnesota with the governor's task force and appropriated $5 million a year for prevention and intervention on FASD. And then when Arnie left office in 99, I felt that this really wasn't just a governmental problem. It was all of our problem, and the private sector needed to be involved. And so that's when I formed a nonprofit called the Minnesota Organization on FAS, which later in 2018 became Proof Alliance.
Susan Carlson, if Minnesota was able to do some pioneering legislation on FASD, and I'm wondering what kind of impact it's had. Have you been able to see better outcomes already in the 20 years since you first started working on this issue and passed that first legislation?
That's an excellent question. And indeed, we have. I think in Minnesota, you need to get a diagnosis, if you want to get a diagnosis of FASD, we have the capacity, not the full capacity if all children were identified, but we have the capacity. And there's a lot of understanding and support for those that do get the diagnosis. Unfortunately, after 20 years of working on this in Minnesota, I began to hear some of the same stories from parents and advocates that the systems didn't understand, and they were always constantly having to educate our systems. When I talk about systems, I talk about your schools, your child welfare, your probation, substance abuse, whatever, wherever these families come into contact with, they did not understand FASD. And so that's when I thought it really would take a social movement, a action on the federal level. And so that's when I became involved with the national organization and headed up the policy team. And that's why we have the FASD Respect Act. And the FASD Respect Act really, when you think about it, and you think about the common name, which is respect, these children have not really had the respect of our systems. Even if, and I saw this as a juvenile court officer, if a child would come in with autism, the system would understand that and deal appropriately. If a child would come in with this hidden disability, and even if they knew there was a lot of prenatal alcohol exposure, they wouldn't understand the importance of getting that child identified and understood by those in that system of care. So that's why the FASD Respect Act is so important.
All right. Well, Susan Carlson, thank you so much for calling in. Susan Shepherd Carlson, retired juvenile court judge and former First Lady of Minnesota, and Constance Mazelski. I know this is something you really want to be able to talk about. Susan Carlson talking about the FASD Respect Act. This is an act just introduced today in Congress.
Actually, it was introduced the end of June.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was introduced the end of June, and we have it's a bipartisan bicameral bill that was introduced in June. But Connie has some very exciting news about the state of Maine. And one of the things that I want to say that we did that's never happened before in this field is the NOFAS policy team and advocates all over the country have been meeting virtually, which we wouldn't have had that opportunity without the pandemic. And so we've had over 100 meetings with advocates and professionals all over the country with members of Congress and their staff. And that was how, which brought us to Maine virtually and with FASD Maine. And they have been absolutely terrific in their advocacy in Maine. So I will turn it over to Connie, and I will let her take it away.
Thank you, Susan Carlson. Connie Mazelsky.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yes, it's a great pleasure to announce today that Senator Collins has announced her co-sponsorship of the FASD Respect Act. It was just announced this morning, and this could be huge for this federal legislation. This legislation could really transform the lives of a lot of people and our systems of care. And her support and sponsorship just means a lot to us in Maine and really nationwide.
Susan Carlson, thanks for calling in. Doug White, what is the sense of how many children are born with FASD? Do we have any sense?
Yeah, it's actually quite staggering. FASDs, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, occur in 2-5% of the general population. That was a study that looked at four different sites, first graders in the general population, and they identified 2-5% of those children with the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So that makes fetal alcohol spectrum disorders more common than autism, cerebral palsy, and trisomy 21 combined. And so the question that comes from that in the face of something so common, why is this not being identified? And if there was anything that was medical that occurred in our children, in 2-5% of our children, 1 in 20 children, this would be a major public health concern. And this, here we are 50 years from when this was first described as fetal alcohol syndrome, and we've made little to no headway. So I think this begs the question of why this is going undiagnosed.
I want to turn to you, Madonna. Doug has been talking about some national figures. What are we seeing here in Maine? Does Maine reflect the national figures that we're hearing about?
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. We don't actually have surveillance and monitoring of FASD in Maine, but what we do have, we have data from the Office of Child and Family Services and the CDC. And we know that in 2020, 901 newborns were reported substance exposed. And in 5 of our counties, 1 in 7 babies, more than 1 in 7 babies were born substance exposed. And half of all of our child removals, that is kids entering foster care, were due to substance use. And the most common substances were alcohol and heroin. And we also know, thanks to the CDC, that 1 in 10 pregnant women in Maine used alcohol during pregnancy. And when you look at individual counties, for instance, Cumberland County, 1/3 of pregnant women used alcohol during pregnancy. So we have this huge issue of prenatal alcohol exposure in Maine, but we don't have enough providers trained to recognize and diagnose FASD. So we have children and adults. We're not finding these children and adults, so we can't help these children and adults who have FASD. It's really sobering.
And I understand one of the big issues that you want to address is stigma, that you believe that women are afraid to tell their doctors that they used alcohol when they were pregnant and therefore don't get treatment early enough. Am I right, Madonna?
Yes, and I think Doug could speak to that better than I. What I would want to speak to about this is that when some of the folks who have contacted us at FASD Maine, one actually is a physician who adopted in Maine. Her child had confirmed prenatal alcohol substance exposure. She was in the foster system in Maine. She had hallmark features. She was one of those children who had hallmark features of FAS. And when she asked for a diagnosis, the child's now in her teens. This physician learned about FAS from me, actually, because she was my mother's doctor and we had conversations about it. And she went to her primary for her daughter to be diagnosed. And the doctor said, why would you want that in your daughter's chart? And then said, nothing to be done. And this is in 2021 with a PCP who should know better. It was really appalling. But I think Doug can really speak to the stigma issue.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons for this. And I think one is that we know alcoholism in society itself is frowned upon, seen as a lack of willpower and not as a disease of alcoholism, which is non-discriminatory. It means it hits people across socioeconomic backgrounds. This is not a disease of the inner city. This is across the racial divide as well. But the other thing that comes with this is alcohol use during pregnancy, and even just alcohol use among women compared to men. With men, it's like going out with the guys. With women, it takes on a whole different quality. And alcohol use by women during pregnancy is almost like people see this as the mother automatically being a bad mother who is trying to harm her child. I've worked in this field for 30 years, and I've never met a mother who was trying to hurt her baby. I've met lots of women who struggle with the disease of alcoholism for many different reasons. And what ends up happening is the alcohol causes brain damage that presents as behavioral issues. So the last reason for stigma is that these children present as bad children. They have behavioral difficulties, and people look at those behavioral issues, call it ADHD or psychiatric illness. And many of these kids come in with a trail of five different psychiatric diagnoses, but no one ever recognizes the underlying neurological problem that comes from brain damage because of alcohol exposure during pregnancy.
And a couple things, Doug, Dr. Wade, I know that many women will not know they're pregnant when they're drinking. And so many pregnancies are unplanned. And also, one of the messages you really, really, really want to get out there is that if a baby is born with FASD and you know this right away, there's so much more you can do if you have the diagnosis early, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, there have been studies by the Center for Disease Control that look at the number of women who drink alcohol during pregnancy, despite the warnings that are on alcoholic beverages. It's up to 11.5% of women, and 3.9% of women binge drink, which is four or more drinks in a sitting. So it's huge. But as you point out, probably most importantly, up to 50% of women are drinking before they find out they're pregnant. And we know about 50% of pregnancies are unplanned. So one of the reasons for the CDC's recommendation that women of childbearing age, if they're using alcohol, should always use protection, is a hope of preventing this. So I think that the risk of not knowing you're pregnant is a major force that drives this.
We do need to take a quick break. We're talking about FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Tandem Coffee Roasters, devoted to spreading joy since 2012. TandemCoffee.com by New England Naturopathic Health, now accepting Anthem Insurance Plans, details at naturopathicme.com, and by Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, food for thought, food for life.
We all need to become more fluent in what good food is all about.
Join us for a conversation between Susan Rockefeller, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, David Rockefeller, a businessman and philanthropist, and Dan Barber, chef and co-owner of Blue Hill at Stone Barns. This is the last episode of our six-part series featuring this year's Summer Institute at College of the Atlantic.
And you can hear that broadcast this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. Not only is Maine Public Television available free over the air, it's also streaming live at mainepublic.org. You can enjoy all of your favorite PBS and Maine Public Television programs and even discover new ones throughout the day. Check it out at mainepublic.org/mptv. And if you're without internet, you can still access Maine Public's four television stations over the air with an HDTV antenna. To learn more about Maine Public Television over the air and for helpful information on choosing your antenna, please visit mainepublic.org, and free access to Maine Public Television is made possible through the generous support of our members. Consider becoming a member today to help deliver this great service to our neighbors throughout Maine.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, addressing the difficulty of diagnosing fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and what can be done. My guest, Dr. Douglas Waite, who is Chief of Developmental Pediatrics at Bronx Care Health System and Assistant Director of Pediatrics at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Also with us, two of the co-founders of FASD Maine, Madonna Mooney and Constance Mazelski. If you have a comment or question, please send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Going to Erin, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Erin. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. My family and I are licensed foster parents within the DHHS system in Maine. And a few years back, we had an infant who we had on and off for 18 months. And just, I really feel like in retrospect, she did have fetal alcohol syndrome. I know that the issues with the mother would have matched that. And just sort of saying, we never received any training for that in recognizing it. And I did have my suspicions when it was pointed out that that could be an issue. So just kind of, you know, I'm excited to hear that this is becoming more in the mainstream and looking at, you know, that to be extended to the foster care community within the state.
And let me ask you that, Connie, what do we know? How could Erin, as a foster care provider, get this training? And also I want to ask you if it's going to be something that becomes part of the training for foster care providers.
One thing we know, Jennifer, is right now in the U.S., there's only one state in the country that requires foster parents to get any training at all in fetal alcohol, and that is Minnesota. And that's just 1 hour of training. So that is something that the FASD Respect Act will work to help facilitate. Well, the FASD Respect Act sets up a framework so that the different systems of care become FASD informed, including the foster parents, who are such an, you know, they're really on the front lines of caring for children who may have been removed because of substance exposure issues or addiction issues. And I mean, I know when my husband and I started learning about adoption, we adopted privately. We did learn about fetal alcohol syndrome.
I'm sorry, did you say you didn't?
We did learn about it. Yeah, we learned about it from a social worker, but it wasn't part of any sort of official training. But we had no idea about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So it took more than a decade to get accurate diagnosis for our child because of the lack of the facial features and other physical characteristics of fetal alcohol syndrome. And when I would bring it up with providers, because I was asking about it, some of them would say, just stop talking about it. Your kid doesn't have it. And I realized I was thinking fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. They were thinking fetal alcohol syndrome. And you know, as Dr. Waite mentioned, only 10% of the people on the spectrum have fetal alcohol syndrome.
Let me ask you, Dr. Waite, we have established that if a child is diagnosed early, that child has the opportunity and potential to live a full life. How does that happen? Let's say a mother comes to you and says, you know what, before I knew I was pregnant, I was drinking a lot. What can you do? How can that child be treated so that that child lives a full life up to his or her potential?
Well, we know there's a developmental trajectory that's very common among kids who have been prenatally exposed to alcohol. And part of this is because of the brain damage that results from the alcohol exposure. And some of those include delay of developmental milestones, especially speech delay. But also very early on, you see kids that are extremely hyperactive, having those terrible two tantrums that just don't go away. And, you know, I wanted to thank that foster parent. I got interested in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders because I was seeing these kids with developmental issues who subsequently became involved in the juvenile justice system, which Susan Carlson was mentioning. And I couldn't explain it. And it was only when I remembered the maybe 30 seconds I had in medical school where they described fetal alcohol syndrome that I began looking into this. And as Connie mentioned, I began to realize this was exactly what was going on. So we talk about 2 to 5% in the general population, but this is extremely common in foster care, at least 20% of kids in foster care. And most of us who work in foster care would say it approaches 40 to 50% have had prenatal exposure. So I think identifying a child gives us a chance to use services that are already in place in the community. But as Connie mentioned, we have to inform those people because right now, if I have diagnosed a child with autism, they go on and all the services just fall into place. And that's because parents of children with autism 30 years ago advocated for this. Before that, there were no services for autism. But right now, we do not have that in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So we need early intervention, school teachers, child welfare workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, and pediatricians to know about this. And we need to have screening of all children in foster care and all people that are involved in the juvenile justice system so that we can begin appreciating the neurological part of these things that present as behavioral issues.
Reading between the lines here, and maybe not even that much between the lines, listening to you and listening to the callers, Madonna, I'll turn to you. It seems as though there are many people in healthcare, there are many doctors, pediatricians in Maine who don't know enough about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Would you say that's true? And if so, how does a parent of a child who they suspect may have FASD, what does a parent of a child like that do?
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. Unfortunately, I would say, go to our website, fasdmaine.org. We have many resources, many links to information for parents, teachers, providers, journal articles, other websites that are designed to train parents, train providers. The AAP has had FASD toolkit for years. Doug can speak to that. They've had a live webinar series free of charge to AAP members, that is American Academy of Pediatrics. Excellent training. Doug is one of those trainers. We keep asking him to come back to Maine. He's going to be speaking next week at the Maternal Child Conference. But I want to mention the reason I have so much interest in FASD is my youngest brother had FASD. And although he was evaluated at age 7 in 1973 at Eastern Maine Medical Center and had many assessments and evaluations throughout his life at very reputable institutions, it wasn't until 2013, he was 47 years old, and he was diagnosed with partial fetal alcohol syndrome, unequivocally. He was one of those kids with the facial abnormalities. And yet he was seen by psychologists and pediatricians and neuropsych folks up into the 2000s. And he was never diagnosed until we took him to a geneticist. And that was because I asked his permission to ask his PCP to make that referral. And he struggled through his life in his school life and adulthood because of these deficits. And he was a classic, unfortunately, example of that. And my mom is an example of someone, she was not a daily drinker or a binge drinker. We know that she drank alcohol in that first month because that's when these facial abnormalities occur. is in that first month of pregnancy when most women don't even know they're pregnant. So as far as education, Doug could probably speak to that too, but what I know of is the AAP certainly has an extensive many years resources for folks to learn about FASD, to diagnose it, to support it. And it's where I learned a lot about it, actually.
And Doug, let me turn to you. And Dr. Waite, let me ask you, how widespread and how extensive do you think the knowledge is among not only pediatricians, but also people's primary care physicians?
It's very lacking. And again, I think doctors themselves have stigma, and there's a lot of reasons I think pediatricians have stigma against women who use alcohol and drugs during pregnancy, largely because they're not aware of alcoholism as a disease and the frequency of alcohol use. So we are working within the American Academy of Pediatrics. We have training programs to diagnose kids with this. There's a new category in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that psychiatrists use called Neurobehavioral Disorder Associated with Prenatal Alcohol Exposure. But we really need to open this up. This is not something that's difficult to diagnose. So we need to take the mystique away. We need to stop focusing on the face and focus on the behaviors. And also, last thing about the AAP, we're working on having all pediatricians screen all children in their practice at least once for prenatal alcohol exposure. And this can be done as we get the prenatal history from the parent in a way that weaves it in that's not stigmatizing. How do you say that, Jennifer?
Stigmatizing, I think.
Stigmatizing. But let me ask
you so much. Something you just said struck me. You said this is not difficult to diagnose. And my understanding is that it was difficult to diagnose. You say this is not difficult to diagnose. Okay, so why not?
Well, you know, it was difficult to diagnose because we were focusing on the face. And people felt that it was much more complicated. Most people, most pediatricians, again, I said, I didn't get training on this, don't know about this. And if doctors weren't trained in medical school, they're not going to be able to practice it. And so one of the issues we're doing with the AAP is we're instituting this in a few programs across the country to teach residents about this so they feel more comfortable. But if you don't screen for prenatal alcohol exposure, you're not going to make this diagnosis. It's basically a child who comes to you with developmental issues and oftentimes with marked issues with social interactions that result in sometimes aggressive behavior, but out of control behavior. And I think Connie can talk a little bit about how she struggled with her children and how this was just overlooked.
Connie.
Yes. One of our children, especially, you know, at first, like super, you know, wonderful, wonderful child, exuberant, talkative, great eye contact, energetic, you know, things that do not overlap with autism, for example, completely different presentation. Anyway, you know, over time people started like dropping hints, like preschool teacher would say, you know, your child is very, you know, has difficulty interacting with other children. This could be a problem. But it didn't really click. I just didn't really know that they were trying to tell me that there could be, you know, an area of concern. And, you know, in elementary school, a lot of the teachers sort of glossed over the issue, but then I would find out that my child wasn't allowed to sit in the circle in kindergarten. You know, they would have my child sit outside the circle because my child had body space issues and, you know, couldn't keep their hands to themselves and so forth. And, you know, things just sort of kept mounting and we started looking for help. And in first grade, you know, not really knowing, we went to a psychologist who was supposed to be a very good diagnostician. We went for 6 months and we knew that we needed to get a diagnosis of something in order to get early intervention from the school. And I finally, you know, basically implored this psychologist, you know, please, can you write a memo, like a one-page memo describing, or like, you know, please label my child with something so we can get some help in school. So anyway, that's how things are for a lot of parents. It was until my child was almost 15 years old that we got accurate diagnosis. And there were probably a dozen different diagnoses along the way. Some of them like very, very concerning because you know, the fit between what my child could do at a certain age and what was expected of them was very, very different. And school became more and more complex and, you know, socially complex as well. And it just became harder and harder to behave as expected.
Yeah, I think that really highlights, Connie, one of the things that I see is children with an FESD can have, most of them have normal to borderline IQ. They're not children who lack in intelligence. What they lack in is the ability to convert that intelligence into what we call adaptive function, the ability to complete day-to-day age-appropriate tasks. And as they get older and the expectations for their age goes up, they fall more and more off the curve of their peers. And so you often have a child who's 12, but really is functioning socially, say, or in terms of communication, like they're a six-year-old, even though they might have an IQ of 120, which is very high. So it's very frustrating. It doesn't make sense to schools. So they tend to look at this as Johnny could do better if only he tried harder, if only he applied himself. Something must be going on at home, and they blame the parents, because they're not looking at this area called adaptive function, and they miss this. And this is frustrating to parents, to teachers, but most importantly to the child who ends up feeling really beaten down.
Well, we do need to take another quick break. We'll have more of your questions and comments when we come back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists, committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome. Proud member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. And by Seaport Credit Union, providing innovative banking solutions while actively supporting Maine's diverse communities. SeaportCU.org.
I'm Robin Young. One key to beating COVID, health experts say, ventilation. Offices and schools can better clean inside air and let more outside air in.
We've kind of stopped letting our buildings breathe, but we need to let them breathe again. We've been designing our buildings for the past 40 years without human health in mind.
Next time, Here and Now.
Stay with us, Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Well, now is a great time, especially if you plan to replace it. When you donate a vehicle to Maine Public during the months of September and October, our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide you with a $500 Lee thank you reward for use towards the purchase of a new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls 19 locations throughout Maine. For complete details, please visit MainePublic.org, and thank you as donated cars, trucks, and SUVs make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we are talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. With me, two co-founders of FASD Maine, Madonna Mooney and Constance Mazelski. Also with us, Dr. Douglas Waite, Colby College graduate and chief of developmental pediatrics at Bronx Care Health System and assistant director of pediatrics at Icahn School of Medicine, Mount Sinai Medical Center. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to Lauren, who's calling from Gray. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
Hi. So many things I can echo that have been said. The adaptive function was particularly good, and that's even a new term for me. But that's our son. So we have been working with this for decades, and until the last 5 years, we didn't know what was going on. In spite of having so many people engaged with our family and our son, teachers, physicians, psychologists, social services, then it got more fun going into the criminal justice system. We had special schools, day schools, residential schools, wilderness programs. No one picked it up. And to make it even more tragic and embarrassing, I am a psychologist, and I directed a substance abuse unit as one of my first vocational endeavors. And we did not get it until the last 6-8 years ago. And by then, it was too late for many of the interventions that would have happened, because there are secondary and tertiary problems that develop, such as the substance abuse, such as the criminal justice. And there are small things that can happen of doing it differently rather than harder, which is the book that opened my eyes. It's by Diane Maldon, a small book, very accessible. I looked at a chart there, and all of a sudden, there's my son. People had brought up fetal alcohol, FAS, and that clearly wasn't him. And people eliminated that because he didn't have those features. But nobody picked up on it. Even today, my colleagues and the judicial system, they'll all say, well, yeah, we know about it, but, and the but is goes off into empty air. An example like with probation, just having a probation officer understand that the reason that they're not showing up for an appointment doesn't mean they're blowing you off. It's executive function. It's adaptive function. And so don't send them back into incarceration for that. Work a system so that they can access their probation. You know, I've seen our son, what he would go through to try to get to probation, where he didn't have some money, and then he couldn't get transportation, and he lost track of time, and then he's back in jail. And once we get people, you know, in the last years working with us, it made a huge difference. But for the most part, people still don't know.
Lauren, thank you so much for your call. And that book is Diane Maldon, Trying Different Rather Than Harder, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah,
and they do show a chart with the high IQ and even giftedness, which was the case with our son, and why people couldn't figure out, you know, what was going on. The theme was, what is going on? So.
Thank you so much for calling in. And Dr. Waite, what strikes me listening to this whole conversation is, you know, obviously alcohol is so prevalent in our society. I mean, I think you used the analogy tip of the iceberg earlier. And let's face it, a lot of people get pregnant while using alcohol, you know, making a choice that they may not make if they were not using alcohol. So I can only imagine when we learn more about this, as we learn more in the future, how widespread alcohol and alcohol use during pregnancy and during the early term of pregnancy is going to be in looking more broadly at societal problems.
Yeah, I think that this is a big point. You know, it's seen as being something natural. It's legal in our society. And again, many times women don't know they're pregnant while they've been drinking. And I think the other piece to keep in mind here is there's been a lot of focus on the opioid epidemic. But most people who use a substance don't just use that substance. And the use of alcohol with opioids is very common. In the days of the 90s, when cocaine was very prevalent, people used cocaine and alcohol. The issue is when babies are born, those substances are measured. Alcohol is left off that toxicology screen. And also the way toxicology screens are done is very racially, socioeconomically skewed. So if you're white and you're middle or upper class, you're not going to get screened. If you're Black and you're lower income class, you're going to probably get screened. It's one of these areas of systemic racism that we've been talking about in our society.
We'll go to Kate, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Kate, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to say, first of all, thank you to Connie and Madonna for starting FASD Maine. I'm delighted that FASD is on the map in Maine. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I have a relative who has fetal alcohol syndrome, and I helped raise him a little bit while he was living at my dad's house. And so this topic's been on my screen for a very long time, but even in school to be a clinical social worker, I don't recall it ever coming up. And I think it's so important to get a diagnosis for anything so that you know that you can go to fasdmaine.org and get resources. One resource I'm really curious about that I learned about a while ago is choline. And I'm wondering if people are using choline to help children with their brain function from the brain damage sustained during the pregnancy.
Kate, thanks for the question. Who wants to take that one? Choline.
I'll take it. There have been research studies with both animals and children that look at giving the vitamin called choline during once a day, twice a day in early childhood. And even, you know, Carl Bell, who came to our 2017 Colby conference that I put together, he came from Chicago and did a lot of research looking at the prevalence of alcohol use in the African-American community. And he really was pushing to get choline added to prenatal vitamins, because the studies show that if you use choline during pregnancy, if you take choline during pregnancy, the alcohol, the effects of alcohol exposure on the developing brain of the fetus is mitigated. Alcohol, you know, the brain is the first thing that develops in the growing fetus. And so the urgency of getting this a diagnosis of pregnancy early on is important. But choline is one of the things that we've been looking at. And the FASD main site has information and links to this information on the use of choline among kids. It's not currently being done widely, but I think there will be a time that it is used. And I think Carl Bell, who has since passed away, a lovely man, was prescient in his push to get us to add this to prenatal vitamins.
All right. Thanks, Kate, for your call. We have an email here from a doctor who says, what is the cure rate given maximal treatment for FASD? What does this treatment cost? What proportion of all Maine children are born with some form of maternal substance use-based phytotoxic effects? It sounds like another question for you, Dr. Waite.
Well, look, I think that when we look at costs, there have been lots of studies that look at costs of raising a child with an FASD. The costs nowhere compare to, these are services that are in place. And, you know, when you talk about a cure, you cannot cure brain damage. We cannot cure traumatic brain injury. We cannot cure a child who has been born after a stroke in utero or after birth that destroys part of the brain. But we do know the brain is plastic early on. And if we can get hands in and working interventions early on, the brain can adapt. The other piece of this we haven't talked about is parent education. These are wonderful kids. They're beautiful kids who are very social and interact one-on-one. But if you put them in a social situation like school, everything seems to fall apart. So really what we're talking about is changing this from a child who won't do something to that they can't. This is a disability. And the reason I use the term disability is it implies you need to give services to lift them up, but also change your expectations to where the child is at. So I think the term cure is, you know, something we look to in medicine for diseases, but the brain is something we have no cure for, but we do have interventions. And the costs of over the course of a lifespan, many of these children do end up involved in foster care in the juvenile justice system, in the psychiatric system, multiple hospitalizations, pales in effect to beginning to institute FASD-based knowledge intervention services.
We'll go to Beverly calling from Fort Fairfield. Hi, Beverly, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about a family member who was drinking alcohol while she was pregnant and said, well, it was only beer. Didn't realize it had an alcohol content. And the child was born, I believe, crying a lot, and I believe that the child was having withdrawal symptoms. And not sure the child had the facial recognition that you folks are talking about. But I did find out about alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, through a book this gentleman had written. He had adopted a child, a boy, and was struggling with the child's issues, and come to find out that the child had the fetal alcohol syndrome. And I think the name of the book was called Adam. I'm not really sure. But that's how I learned about it. And then I went, when I found out my family issue there with a family member, I went on the website. And under the fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, there were three subsets. And the child family member fit to a T one of the subsets. The child had a short attention span, given a project, would just kind of walk away, just, you know.
Oh, Beverly, how old is that child now, and how is he doing?
Oh, that child was close to 40. And was killed in an automobile accident.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
And
the talked to the mother and complete denial that anything was wrong with the child. And I did get a chance to talk to the father that didn't have any interaction with each other. But I asked the father if there was anything like that on his side of the family, and he said no.
Beverly, thank you for calling and sharing your story. Madonna, we just have a few seconds left, and I just wanted to ask you if you have any advice about talking to somebody who may be worried about somebody else in their family, somebody who is pregnant, and just some advice about ways to talk to that person about their pregnancy and alcohol.
Well, thanks for asking me, but I have to tell you, Doug is the expert
okay.
in this department.
Okay, go ahead, Doug. Just a few seconds.
No, I think that we know that alcohol is a neurotoxin. That means it kills brain cells. Would you, while you're pregnant, drink lead? Right? Would you drink, you know, a neurotoxin, knowingly drinking a neurotoxin that we know kills brain cells? Well, that's what you're doing when you drink. And I'm saying that not to be judgmental. Because again, alcoholism is a disease that requires treatment. We as doctors are not good at treating this. These are good people who have an illness.
Well, thank you so much, all three of you, for joining us today. And there will be all sorts of resources on our website and Facebook page as well. Dr. Douglas Waite, Chief of Developmental Pediatrics at Bronx Care Health System. Madonna Mooney and Constance Mazelski, co-founder of FASD Maine. Today's sound engineer, George Thomas, Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, addressing hate crimes in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.